Well, there's always a risk, I think, when one is in theosophical gatherings and when one travels round the country, first one country and then another, one group and then another, and one is never really quite sure what one has said to this group and what one hasn't said. And therefore there is continually a risk of repeating oneself without meaning to. But at the same time, I think that if we look at the scene of the moment, there always seem to be certain things which you feel you want to say, even though you may have said them elsewhere. Because we do stand in the society, as in the world, in a state of changeover, so to speak. We have had an extraordinary beginnings, I suppose, in this first 100 years of our existence, with these magnificent people who have led the society right up till today. And one means no offense to anyone, of course, in saying this, but with Brother Sri Ram, we seem to come to the end of a sort of, what would you call it, a dynasty or something of that sort in the theosophical work. It's not quite so clear to see what sort of people are going to be around in the coming 100 years. And so, in a sense, the society does stand at the beginning of something new. And this is also true insofar as the world around us is changing so tremendously. So that the circumstances in which we are now able to work are totally different from the circumstances of 100 years ago. One cannot but have tremendous respect and reverence, I think, for the early founders who must have found themselves in such an extraordinary position. In those days, I suppose, news could reach New Zealand from Europe and vice versa. Perhaps 4 or 5 months it would take. No television, not even radio, no telephone connections. So that communications were totally different from what they are now. And yet here come some people on the scene, and they're talking about universal this and universal that. Brotherhood without distinction. Of course, the objects didn't develop for a little while until the present way we have of repeating them. But still, ideas of universality, universal brotherhood, just must have seemed quite crazy, I feel, in those days. Nobody thought in terms of universal brotherhood. And as between religions, good heavens. I can imagine the comments that must have been made in the drawing rooms of London and Paris and New York, so to speak, about this idea. And here they were bravely battling on with a new idea. And how difficult it must have been. And here we are today in a totally different situation where news media are available to us partially at any rate. If we have the money, we can buy time, perhaps, on the television or the radio. And in America, they do a great deal of this, of course. Totally different concepts reign in the world. There are many world organizations. There is a very real feeling, especially amongst the rising generation, for the brotherhood of man in the broadest possible sense. So we work in a very different media, in a very different field from our early founders. And this, again, creates a new situation for us. Alongside this again, probably, is the tremendous growth, especially since the war, of other occult or pseudo-occult organizations. And whereas, in one sense, perhaps, they attract to themselves people who are interested more or less only in the sensational or the psychic or perhaps self-development in some form or another, they do seem at the same time to act as competitors, rather, to the Theosophical Society itself. And this again is different, because in the early days there were no competitors. There only was this society. And a great many of these others have sprung from it in one way or another. This again creates a different situation, it seems to me, from that of 100 years ago. What doesn't change, I suppose, or very little, are the eternal verities. I only say very little, because it does seem to me that even the Logos must somehow or other change slightly through all this experience of making solar systems and worlds, and I suppose he does change slightly. Doesn't much matter to you and me, I don't think. But I dare say even the eternal verities are in a stage of evolution in from one point of view. But as far as we're concerned, they remain eternal. These are the same, and they require, even in this different field, the same support, the same earnest allegiance, shall we say, and dedication, as they must have done in those early days. But things appear easy to us. And in this modern world, we are tremendously conditioned, we can't help it, by the sort of life that we have created for ourselves in this civilization. So that very few of us are as free, perhaps, as perhaps the early members were. We have commitments of various kinds. We can't compare ourselves wholly to HPB and Colonel Alcott, who were, to all intents and purposes, free from personal family commitments, at any rate. And many of us have these commitments still. Nevertheless, I think we can learn something from their attitude. And I think perhaps we need to learn something from their attitude. This attitude of complete dedication and complete, 100% commitment to the theosophical work. And as both the chairman of the meeting and our general secretary has said, I have had a great many opportunities, not only in these last 2 years, but on many other occasions, of visiting the Theosophical Society in different parts of the world. And although you do find people who have a tremendous commitment, you also find enormous numbers of members who don't appear to have it. Maybe we shouldn't judge by these appearances. But we too easily hear the excuses of people who are always saying, I'm sorry, I couldn't come to the meeting because I had to do this. I would so love to hear theosophists say, I was going to a meeting this evening, but I gave it up for the sake of the society. That's what I should love to hear, and I practically never, never do, never. It's always the other way around. Everybody has such good reasons and such good excuses for doing other things. And so rarely do you find individuals who seem to be putting the society high, really high, on the list of their priorities. And oh, such good excuses, such good excuses. But I don't think we can expect to build our society in the future on that kind of pattern. I don't see how we can. I think the reason the society has endured for 100 years so strongly is partly due to the immense personal sacrifice of some of those early people. And although we shouldn't eschew money, and indeed in this civilization we need money, it isn't really basically on money that we live. It's on the sacrifice of people that we really live. If we're going to pretend to be something in the nature of a spiritual society, if we're going to pretend to be something of the sort of a really spiritual occult society, it is on personal sacrifice, really, that we live. Although it's nice to have money too. We can see how in America, for instance, the Kern Foundation has immensely helped in the publication of these beautiful books. And so I think we need to try and look at that early scene in our society and try to sort of picture what it was and what it felt like. Because I believe that this spirit of dedication is to be seen very strongly in those early days. And I think that if I had the power to insist, well, perhaps I wouldn't use it if I did have the power, because one mustn't do those things, really, must one? But I would certainly recommend to every member joining the society, and to every old member who hasn't yet had the interest to do it, to read Colonel Alcott's old diary leaves and other books about the early history of the society, in order to get steeped in what it felt like in those days. I know that in talking like this, one is in danger of giving the impression that one feels the Theosophical Society is just so tremendously special There are other pebbles on the beach, indeed. But I still do think it is rather special. But it is we who are going to continue to keep it special, so to speak. If we don't do that, perhaps it will just relapse into one of many useful little organizations pulling a little weight here and there. But it started out surely in some other way than that, didn't it? And this is something to do with the masters. And we don't want to make dogmas about the masters. HPB herself warned of this and said that in the very, very early days, the founders of the society had to take care about it. They had to oppose in the strongest manner possible anything approaching dogmatic faith and fanaticism, belief in the infallibility of the masters, or even in the very existence of our invisible teachers, having to be checked from the first. I might go on reading that paragraph because it's rather fun. On the other hand, as a great respect for the private views and creeds of every member was demanded, any fellow criticizing the faith or belief of another fellow, hurting his feelings, or showing a reprehensible self-assertion unasked, such a member incurred expulsion from the society. Imagine. That was something, wasn't it? The greatest spirit of free research, untrammeled by anyone or anything, had to be encouraged. Thus, for the first year, the members of the TS body, representing every class in society and every creed and belief, Christian clergymen, spiritualists, free thinkers, mystics, masons, and materialists, lived and met under these rules in peace and friendship. There were two or three expulsions for slander and backbiting. There's HPB for you, see. If you didn't toe the line, out you go. None of this sort of sentimentality that we tend to have. Ooh. Of course, I know that Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so, sometimes Miss So-and-so, is an awful gossip. But still, after all, you can't turn her out. Wouldn't that be our attitude? Well, of course, perhaps you don't have any gossips in this lodge, I don't know. But they certainly exist within the society here and there. And we don't turn them out because we think it would be unbrotherly. But HPB was a kind of black and white person, you know. She didn't think in those terms. You either do the job or you don't. If you can't maintain the standard, out you go. And that was her attitude, rather. And we don't have anything like that today, as far as I can see. Anyway, although we may not make dogmas about the masters, and we may think of them as we wish, or not think of them at all, it's perfectly clear, I think, that from HPB's point of view, they must have been very real people. And there are stories, current, in writing, in the theosophical literature, about many occasions when conversations took place with them. And HPB herself was at the master's ashram in Tibet for quite a while, a number of years. She could hardly be expected to think of her master, therefore, simply as a figment of her imagination, or as a hypothesis, or something like this. They were real people who played a tremendous part in the lives of Colonel Olcott and HPB. And, I suppose, HPB had a great reverence, a real reverence, for them, because she knew, perhaps better than many of us do, or perhaps better than all of us do, what really an adept is. We can read about adeptship in our literature, and we can discover there that it refers to someone who's taken the fifth initiation, perhaps, and gone beyond it. But really, what do we know? If I ask you, or you ask me, what's the difference between the fourth and the fifth initiation? Well, are we likely to be able to say very much that's useful? Not really. We don't really know much about it, do we? But HPB, I expect, did know, you see, far more. She lived with it. She was in contact with those kind of people, so to speak. She must have had a deep appreciation of what it takes to be an adept, quite apart from the occult side. It's the realization of the work involved in it, in the sheer hard work, tackling the problems of life, perhaps life after life, with tremendous assiduity, not being turned aside by things of lesser importance, always discriminating as to the best use of the energies available, of the time available, of the money available, perhaps. putting it first, and next life again, putting it first, not second, not third, first. The sheer hard work involved in this, of commitment and dedication and duty. Now she must have known what that was, and therefore she had a tremendous respect for individuals who could so train themselves and dedicate and devote themselves to the service of humanity, so to speak, as finally to reach that lofty stage of consciousness. And then again, if we put ourselves in the position of HPB, you can see from her writings how she quarrels, for instance, with everybody's idea of God. Her idea was essentially this oneness, which we speak of in our society, as being the background to all things. This is the only thing, and must for her have been the only thing, which you could possibly call God. She mightn't have used that word. Whatever this power is, whatever this majesty is, whatever this tremendous something is in the universe, it reflects itself in its many laws and its many agencies. And for our planet, there is a brotherhood which acts as the agent, as it were, of that power and that source and that light for this particular earth. From whom did the direction come, the inspiration come for the founding of the Theosophical Society? It came from no less a source than that brotherhood. That's where it came from. So that from the point of view of HPB and Colonel Alcott, it couldn't have come from any higher source. There was no other higher source, in imagination even, from which it could come. Nothing less than that. Can you be surprised, therefore, that they gave themselves to it so completely and so wholly, right from the time they started until they died, never caring for their own comfort, for instance, never caring for the criticism of people, never caring what happened to them, really, except that being human they complained from time to time, of course, but they never stopped. They went on with the work because they knew what the work was, I suppose. HPB refers to it, others have done so, the Master KH refers to it, that at the end of each century a special effort is made by that brotherhood to try and alleviate the foolishness of men. And this is what they were involved in. They were asked, as it were, or commanded, whichever way you like to think it, to come and do this job. This is a job that is being attempted by the brotherhood for humanity, to try and help the world. And so they felt, I don't know how to put it so in a way, but I tried to feel what it could feel like to be part of this, to be part of this effort to help the world, that somehow streaming from behind was the force and the love and the interest to do something, not just for a few theosophists, if you see what I mean, but for the world, for the whole world, and for everything in it. And so they must have felt this, you see, strongly. It must have been their very life. And so, of course, they could do nothing but give themselves to it completely and utterly, putting everything else aside as of being of lesser consequence. And I think you look at their lives, and they had very difficult lives, lives of tremendous sacrifice, bad health, HPB, deserted, pilloried, criticized, ostracized. Every sort of thing happened to her, but she never gave up. Never. She never could have imagined giving up, I feel, really. Not in her heart of hearts. Whatever, as a sick old lady, she might perhaps sometimes have said. Colonel Alcott, too, traveling around in bullock carts all over India. Nothing in the world could be more uncomfortable than a bullock cart. And he literally did go for thousands of miles, not knowing when he would arrive and what he was going to eat and where he would sleep. But he had his instructions. Go out and start the Theosophical Society. And so he went out and he started it. Now, this is the background. This is, may I say, I don't think it's only my opinion. You read about it and you'll find out too. This really is the background. This is how the society started. It may make us a little special. I think it does. But what are we doing about it? How do we measure up to this standard? Well, as I say, we have commitments of various kinds outside the society, of course, and responsibilities with families and so on. We're not as free as Colonel Alcott and HPB were. But if we make a list of priorities in our lives, what really does come first? How easily we slip into saying, well, I must do this, you know, and I have to do that. And I've heard it, you've heard it, I do it myself, I expect. But are we really right to do that? Is it sensible to do that as members of the society and as people who would like to call themselves theosophists? Now, if somebody says to you, or someone says to me, what do you really mean by being a theosophist? What do you think you are? All of us would answer in a more or less this way, I suppose. We would say, well, we believe, you know, that man is a spiritual person, basically. He has his roots in the divine. He is the prodigal son who's come out from the father's house to the far country, which is this world, in order to learn the experiences that he cannot gain at home. He uses instruments to gain these experiences. He has bodies which he wears, one for this purpose, another for another purpose. But the bodies are not him. We know this. We'd all say that. We'd all say we know it, whether we do or not. We know we're not the bodies. We are really the spiritual self. We are the soul. We are the reincarnating ego. What really matters, of course, is this this real self and the values and the standards of that real self. These are the things that matter to us. These are the things which we try or should practice in our lives. These are the values rather than the values of time which should guide our actions and our whole life. Well, I don't know what your friends would say to you because I don't know you well enough, but the friends of mine who know me well enough would probably say to me, well, that's all very well, but why don't you do it? Because if they look at me in my life, they probably see that just like everybody else, I'm putting everything first, and the Theosophical Society is way down on the list of priorities in my life. As it is in the lives of so many of us, I'm afraid. And I can't see that that's a good thing for the future of our society. I do think we've got to somehow get imbued with this spirit of knowing what it's about. That the society wasn't here just for a group of theosophist members. The society is here to help the world. We may go through a period of learning. I would describe it as being a little bird in a nest with his mouth open, being fed. But it doesn't go on forever. No little bird stays very long in its nest like that. It's got to go out and fend for itself. And so we gradually must change over from being the sort of member who comes in to learn a few things to the person who's actually interested in helping the world, in trying to make this wisdom available to the world in which he lives, so that there isn't a person anywhere who hasn't heard of theosophy. Now, this is not the case. I was saying to someone this morning that in my travels in Australia, New Zealand, and this applies in America as well, in this last year or two, I only met one person that was in Australia in a TV show, only one person who really knew what theosophy was. All these other interviewers from newspapers and so on, they always say, I'm sorry, Mr. Goetz, I don't really know what theosophy is. Tell me about it. And even today, I went to Woman's Weekly today, and I had quite a long talk with a charming person there, and she started off in exactly the same way. She said, I'm very sorry, Mr. Coates, but I don't really know anything about theosophy. What is it? Never heard about it. Well, I think this is all wrong, you see, somehow or other. I know that people struggle manfully to try and get our ideas about. It isn't that there aren't people who do this, but somehow we haven't completely got them out, have we? I do believe that when people say, when you're ready for it, you'll find it. I think this is true. But I believe we could have our door wider open in some way so that more people did know of our existence than do. I think this matter of availability is of tremendous importance today, and especially insofar as it is important, and I think it is, that we should be contacting some of the younger people in the world. You get a theosophical audience and the percentage of older people is huge, almost always. And yet you have a rising generation all over the world who are really looking for theosophy. But they haven't the slightest idea that what they're looking for sails under the banner of theosophy. Talking to two young people in Gisborne the other day, I asked them what the word meant to them. And they consulted with one another for a moment, and then they said, well, we think it sounds rather churchy. Well, I guess it does. What we're going to do about this, I don't know. It may be one of our problems in the future throughout the whole theosophical world. Because one thing the society is not is churchy. And we don't want to appear churchy. We want to be universal, as it were, in our appeal. How we're going to achieve this, I don't know. But it looks as though it's part of the need for this availability business. In Paris, in front of the great big shops on the boulevard, you see these étalages which they put out in front. And there you see stalls with this on it and that on it and all the kind of things that they sell in that particular shop. And the passers-by going past about their own business, they can just look at the things as they go past and they go on their way. And it may be a week, a month, a year. Someone thinks, well, I need a new pair of socks. I saw some nice socks there. I'll go back and buy it. So somehow we have to have our theosophy. We have to have an étalage. We have to have a display somehow or other in such a way that the world knows we exist. The whole world, not just a few people, but everybody. A person may see our display, so to speak, maybe 10 years before a problem brings that person back to look up for a book that they thought they saw there 10 years before. We can't make people into members and shouldn't do so. But I do think this availability is of immense importance. Now, it's a very happy thing to me to find that you have a bookshop, for instance, which is open from, I don't know what times, it doesn't matter, but it's open every day, it's open regularly. This is an immense important thing. You've no idea how rare this is in the theosophical world. I go to lodge after lodge after lodge all over the place where they have a fine library, and the chairman at the end of the meeting will always say, we have a splendid lending library, which is true. It's open at such and such a time on Mondays and another time on Wednesdays and another time on Fridays. And by that time, when he's reiterated all the various hours that the lodge is open, nobody knows anymore when it's open. And so nobody comes to it. They've been trying this out in America, and I expect they're having the same experience now over there as you have here, I imagine. They wanted to get the lodge library open all the time, every day. And of course they couldn't get the busy younger people to do much about it because they're all working in jobs. And so the work of keeping the library open fell upon the older members. And oh, you wouldn't believe the excuses that all the older members made in order not to have to do anything for the society. Every single excuse that you can imagine. Too far, too tired, too old, no bus. I don't know anything about books. I don't know how to talk to people. Every conceivable excuse. However, finally, they bludgeoned some of the older members into doing it. They said, after all, what's the good of belonging to the society if you're not prepared to do something for it? Surely you're not there just as a sort of, sort of hanger-on, an armchair theosophist. You've got to do something for it. And they really rather tackled some of these older members. And finally, they got enough people to look after the libraries. And now, far from regretting this, some of the older members vie with one another to get onto this library roster. Because they are all having such fun. Many of them are older people living alone, without very much excitement in their lives, and now they're finding really a new lease of life in this, in these libraries, you see. Every sort of person comes in. The library subscribers are growing in number all the time, and they get all, of course, the hippie brigade in and all that, which is very exciting. They come in bare feet and beads and everything like this. And some of our old ladies don't know what to do about it, of course. I mean, they're really having a terrific time. I mean, hippie comes in and he takes out the secret doctrine because they go for some of the most serious books. And there he will lie, long length, stretched on the floor, of course, because they like being on the floor. And the disdain chairs, always on the floor. And reading the secret doctrine perhaps for 5 hours or something like that. It's quite annoyed when they say the library's got to close now. And they're having the time of their lives, some of these older people. And it is getting across to the public, you see. Well, you're doing that here already, so I don't need to encourage you to do it. You're one of the few lodges, however, I think perhaps who has done it for quite a while. But it is of great value. We have so many thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of theosophical books in cupboards which practically never speaking get unlocked. Yeah, I've seen them, lodge after lodge after lodge, beautiful books, locked up carefully. You can't open the door if you want to. Nobody ever does open it, I don't think. Now, what's the good of all that? What's the good of books that no one ever reads? So we must make them available. You see what I mean? We must. It's become a must in this day and age. It's not just a hope. We could do something about this, and everybody's got to do it. Everyone. Not just the president of the lodge. The president of the lodge, I'm sure, does all she can, but she can't do everything. How can she? Everybody's got to work at this. We are all in this movement together. We've all got to use the Theosophical Society as an instrument to get at the world. The time makes it essential that we all do this, not just a few of us. You might try a few new methods. For instance, I think I explained to some group or other, I don't know where it was, a new idea we tried out in London, in our headquarters, perhaps two or three years ago, but it's just before I left, really, on my trip. And they arranged all the chairs in the hall, instead of like this, they arranged them in circles of six. Six, 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 all the way through the hall. The public came in as usual for the public lecture and looked very confused at seeing the chairs in this position and started to try and straighten them out. You see? Well, the steward said, no, they're meant to be like that. You just sit down. So people sat down rather gingerly, you know, with their backs to the platform, some of them, and so on. And there was a short talk of introduction on a subject. And then each of these little sixes was given a question written on a piece of paper to do with the subject and told to discuss. What is your answer to this question? So there's a babel of voices in no time with everybody discussing their questions all around the room, you see. And then about a quarter of an hour before the end, each little group had a spokesman who got up and read the question on the paper and gave the answer of their group. And so that each person in the hall not only heard what all the others had been talking about, but somehow felt that they had contributed to this. There was an audience participation involved. And then finally the chairman summed up, and it was really, I think, a very successful meeting. Well, we do serve coffee and tea and sandwiches and things after our meetings, even the public ones in London, and we just couldn't get the people out of the house. They were chattering away with each other for hours afterwards, but they were really excited at having been involved. Now, I think this is something that could be tried out in other places. After all, what do you lose by it? You can't lose anything by it. You can only amuse people. Try something different. I believe that we should. I don't think the ordinary straight lecture is going to perhaps be as useful in the future as it has been in the past. Another thing I think I may have told some of you, when I was in San Jose in Costa Rica, the lodge there had come to the conclusion that it didn't get enough new people coming to their lectures. And so they decided to take a leaf out of the university's book, so to speak, and run a course of lectures. Because in universities, students get accustomed to courses of this and courses of that. And so they got the lodge together, and again, a bit of bludgeoning, if you understand my words. All the members had to do something about it. You see, instead of just two or three members doing everything and the rest just sitting like stookies. Stookies is a nice Scotch word, so if you don't understand what it is, well, I won't translate it. But there are people in this life who sit like stookies. And they got everybody going, you see, to do something. And the members had to get together because they were found that on the course they've got to give a certain talk on a certain date, you see. So there had to be much research, much seeking, much reading, much preparation. And everybody got involved in it, and they started well ahead of time, and they did good advertisements. They decided on a course of 6 weeks, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, for 6 weeks. And then they put up notices all over the place and in the university. You know, I was there, and they had about 55 people attending that course, and they paid for it too, not very much, but just a little. And 55, of whom 35 were from the university, 35 students, who'd never come to this society before. And, of course, they could use the books in the library and all that sort of thing. I mean, I was only there in the middle of it, so I don't know what the end of it is. I don't know whether they've gained a great many members from it. This I can't tell, of course. Not in touch. But I think it was a very good idea to get people to the rooms of the society, to the library and so on, to make the library available. I think we should try some of these things. And I do think a course of lectures is something which appeals today to a great many of the younger people, because they're used to this. We've had in our headquarters in London also a course in yoga, course of lectures dealing with yoga. That brings lots of people in. Sometimes they're not always happy, because we have this problem of those who want to go ahead with all kinds of special exercises for development and so on, and we're not really concerned to teach that in public lectures. But it did bring a lot of people. I think we must try and be tremendously in touch with the times we're in. I think that there are lots of people in the world, in our theosophical world, who are not in touch. I'm afraid I do think so. In a big city like this, it's perhaps not so true. I don't know about that. But there are many places where there's a little theosophical group, and it lives in itself, so to speak. It's kind of inbred. You see what I mean? And it's not really in contact with the things. You will have heard the story, a quite true story, of Dr. Besant on one occasion in England visiting a lodge in the north. And she was accompanied to the railway station. I believe it was in Manchester. And she was being seen back onto a train to London. And the president of the lodge said to her, "Dr. Besant, do you think our lodge is doing well, or doing its stuff?" And Dr. Besant didn't say yes or no. She looked around this crowded station where hundreds of people were running to and from trains. She just did that and said, "Do you think all these people have heard of your lodge?" And that's all she said. Well, he got his answer. But I don't suppose it was the answer he wanted, of course. But you see, I think Dr. Besant also perhaps must have been thinking that the Theosophical Lodge should be such a center of enlightenment, of good works, perhaps, of nice people, always ready to help everyone else and so on, giving themselves to serve the world in all sorts of manners. I think she must have felt that that's what the lodge should be like. And when you do have a group of such people, I suppose it would get known. So I mean, even if you went to the city council of Auckland, somebody went there and said, I want to get up a subscription for the blind, shall we say. I would like to get some people to help me. And they would say, "Oh, well, why don't you go along to the Theosophical Society? They're the kind of people who would help you with that." But would the city council in Auckland say that of us? You see what I mean? I think this was Dr. Besant's idea. It's a thing for everyone to be involved in. And terribly necessary, I think, today, that we get this availability of our because it's the wisdom, to all kinds of people who perhaps have never heard of it. Now, dear, dear, look at that old time. It does march on, doesn't it? And I'm sure the kettle's boiling already. A small statement by HBB which I could share with you. "We are not working merely that people may call themselves theosophists." This is, we're not working just so that you and I can call ourselves theosophists, but that the doctrine we cherish may affect and leaven the whole mind of this century. The whole mind of this century. That means everybody, doesn't it? "This alone can be accomplished by a small, earnest band of workers who work for no human reward, no earthly recognition, but who, supported and sustained by a belief in that universal brotherhood of which our masters are a part, work steadily and faithfully, first in understanding, and then in putting forth for consideration the doctrines of life and duty that have come down to us from time immemorial." See, first of all in understanding, that means study, and then in putting forth for consideration, that means making it available, the doctrines of life and duty that have come down to us from time immemorial. "Falter not so long as a few devoted ones will work to keep the nucleus existing. You were not directed to found and realize a universal brotherhood, but to form a nucleus for one. And a nucleus is an active thing within a cell, so far as I understand. It's, so to speak, like a little channel, which is giving the life forces, distributing them for various purposes throughout that particular cell. That means that each one of us, then, is like a nucleus. The lodge is a nucleus, the section, the society in the world is a nucleus. Each one of us should perhaps be aware of his nucleus quality as a channel, as it were, all the time, not just on lodge evenings, but all through his life, her life. That we are here to do a work, if you see what I mean. This is really the important thing. So we have to look, first of all, into ourselves. We also are conditioned. I know lecturers, and that includes me, think that the world is very conditioned, and I do think so, but I think that we in the Theosophical Society are conditioned. I have heard of people in the society, and one meets them, who have read, perhaps, every book that some author has written and have, to all intents and purposes, read nothing else. And yet they feel themselves to be quite conversant with Theosophy. Now, I wonder whether that's really a true position. I doubt it myself. There are people, for instance, who you might call Blavatsky Theosophists. There are certainly Besant Theosophists. There are Leadbeater Theosophists. There might even in this country conceivably be Hodgson Theosophists. You see what I mean? People who have been particularly devoted to one person's way of expressing Theosophy and have in fact not really read anything else. I mean, I'm not going to do it because for obvious reasons it would be an unsuitable thing to do, I think. But supposing I was to say in this room, put up your hands all those people who have never read one of HPB's books, for instance. There might be people in this room who have never read anything from HPB at all. There could be. There may be people here who have never looked into the secret doctrine, who have never looked at the key to Theosophy, who don't even know about the voice of the silence, and things of this kind. There might be people in this room who haven't. Now, in this sense, I think we are conditioned Theosophists, because we've read just about one presentation, instead of acquainting ourselves with other presentations and thereby getting other stance, other illuminations, other lights on this total subject from different sources and different angles. And I think we should be better representatives of our society and better able to do, as she says in this little statement, to put forth for consideration the doctrines of life and duty that come down to us. If we really studied those doctrines of life and duty a little bit more than we do. And that would mean, perhaps, studying them from the point of view of how HPB saw them, what the masters have written about them, what Dr. Besant and Yabel have written, what other authors like Geoffrey Hodgson and perhaps others have written, so that we have an eclectic view, we have a more general picture of the whole thing. Now, you will find that there are certain places and certain subjects in which Theosophical writers disagree, or at any rate, if they don't disagree, they present things in apparently conflicting manners. I don't know that they really conflict, but they appear to on the surface, especially perhaps on the subject of after death, where the Master K.H. writes very definitely in some of his instructions to Synod, in a manner which is very different to some of the other things that people have written about it. It's not up to us to say who's right and who's wrong. Probably nobody's wrong. There may be just to be different ways of looking at the same thing. But I think we shouldn't think of ourselves as being well-read Theosophists, so to speak, if we don't read what other people have written. Now, what happened in many countries, especially in non-English-speaking countries, was that sections was perhaps founded, lodges started, around the turn of the century. HPB had passed over about 10 years before. Dr. Besant, CWL, were in their heyday, so to speak. They were turning out books and masses of lectures and so on in a most wonderful manner. So that if you were in Italy, for instance, and you wanted to get a theosophical book, you had with difficulty collected enough money to get it translated and published in Italian, you would want to get the latest book. And so they published the latest book. And so they did in German, and so they did in Swedish, and so they did in Dutch, and so on. And you know, it took quite a long time for those sections to get anything published from HPB, who was, after all, the real original founder. And only in the last 10 years or so, since I've been to do with Europe, though it isn't due to me, I'm not saying that, but because this is how I know about it, that in Italy, for instance, that the Key to Theosophy and Isis Unveiled and the Secret Doctrine have finally been translated into Italian and published. And this has made a profound effect on the membership, because they say, but we've never seen this before. Why didn't we have this before? They're thrilled about this particular way of putting it, the way HPB does. But you know, I think that in the English-speaking world, there are thousands of members also who never really have read the early presentation. And it seems to me reasonable to think that we ought to. I don't know whether one should use the word ought or not, but I, as HPB was the original founder, I think we ought to read what she says. I mean, that's what I think. And this doesn't mean that one is being critical of anybody else at all. One isn't. There's no need to be critical of anybody else. It's not in any way derogatory to anyone else, to all the wonderful work done by Dr. Besant and C. Dalbuel and all the others, who've done noble and marvelous work and led equally self-sacrificing lives, because this is true, as the early founders. But we need to know, I think, something of that rather straightforward, unsentimental, rather strong presentation that came in the early days. I believe we should be a stronger society for the next 200 years if we did this. I would say myself that every lodge should have a study group. And I don't think every lodge does have a study group. It would mean that one more night a week has got to be given up to theosophy. And why not, if it really means something? If it's really high on our priorities? I hope you don't think I'm talking out of turn in saying this, but it's because I really do feel for the Theosophical Society. I'm anxious it should go on strongly with strong people who know about theosophy to support it and lead it and guide it into the future. And I believe that we are not putting ourselves sufficiently in that position because we don't really know enough about its beginnings and its early teachings and so on. I think this is a very vital thing for the future. Another thing that is worth mentioning, perhaps, I won't go on much longer, is the need for us to pursue our, to formulate our own philosophy. Dr. Arundel was forever saying, you know, that we should find our own theosophy. And people often used to wonder what he meant by our own theosophy. Well, I think it's perhaps comparable to the world of music, where great composers have brought down from the heaven of music, whatever it may be, wonderful ideas which they have translated into music, into symphonies and concertos and so on. And they have not been worried one little bit because they didn't see music or translate or manifest or express music in the same way as some other composer did. I don't suppose it worried Beethoven one little bit that he didn't do it in the same way as Bach. Why should it worry him? He had brought down just as vital, and it depends which you like best, perhaps better music. You see what I mean? You can't really compare it, can you? And so I think it is with the art, with truth must be like that. It must be even bigger than music, so to speak. If we can make a contact with truth, we shall bring truth down. We shall be the truth as we understand it. And if it's exactly the same as someone else's, all right. But if it isn't, also, all right. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to agree in every detail with what somebody else has written. We have to hold these things lightly, because there is room within the totality of truth for so many points of view, it seems to me. On the other hand, I think we do have to find our own. If HPB and Dr. Besant and others could influence such enormous numbers of people as they did, it's because they went to the well of truth themselves. And there they brought up, as it were, their buckets of truth from the well of truth and watered large areas of human ignorance with it and helped so many people. But can we live on that secondhand forever? I think not. I think whether it's now or some other life, every one of us has got to go to that well of truth and bring up our own truth from it. It may only be a thimbleful, maybe only an egg cupful. We may not be able to water very much land with it, but it'd be our contact, our own individual real contact with the truth that is. So that we don't need to be parrots of other people. We don't need to go on repeating just what other people have said and so on, although there may sometimes be reason for doing this to emphasize points. We want to feel free to find our own truth and our own interpretation. I think that will make us more interesting people. Because after all, the society is going to be judged not by what we say, but what we are. Not by what we pretend, but what we do. It is in our own lives, really, that we have to bring this theosophy, so as to live it in the face of the world, and quite obviously so. I think this is most important. It's so easy to be a kind of second-hand person. And when in the beginning, naturally, one is. But more and more, I think the individual member has to find his own way, has to find his own interpretation of truth, his own inner deep realization, and not to be afraid, not to be ashamed of whatever that may be, without asserting too much, and certainly not thinking ever that you're better than anyone else or anything like this. But realizing that each individual must one day do this, you see. It's likely, I was mentioning yesterday, I suppose, or in the public lecture, the people in India who take their begging bowls in their hands and they go out to seek God and reality. The individual must do it. Each individual, nobody can do it for him, or for you, or for me. We must do this individually. And I think our membership of the Theosophical Society invites us to this, to finding our own truth. Anyway, this is what Dr. Arundel so often used to say to us. And he was a very remarkable person. I suppose you won't mind if I tell you about him and the way he used to make us laugh on occasions. He had one delightful way of dealing with the people who talked about all their magnificent past incarnations. As president of the society, I suppose he was victimized frequently by people who remembered themselves in important and illustrious positions as statesmen and princesses of Egypt and all this kind of thing. And he would listen, you know, quietly and apparently with sympathy to the person, you know, and say, he nod his head and say, yes. And then he would go up to them afterward and say, but my dear, what has happened to you? And really, it was a tremendously good way of dealing with the situation, because it wasn't rude in any way. It wasn't really unkind. But somehow, it put the whole situation just as it was, in a nutshell. I mean, you never meet people who come along and tell you what a wonderful life they had as a dairy maid, do you? You never do. No. It doesn't happen like that. Dr. Arundel was wonderful, you know. And he was a magnificent person. You know, it was he whom I saw stopping his heartbeat and his breathing and so on and his test conditions for about 20 minutes. Extraordinary. And started his roll up again. I remember working in his office with him in Adyar. And one day, well, it happened on several occasions, there was a big pile of mail. And he took up the letter, he put it to his forehead, and he told us what was in it. I was there with another secretary of his. He put it down, picked up the next letter, put it to his forehead. He told us what was in the letter. And we opened them all, and he was quite right. He had everything. He could do all kinds of those sort of tricks, you know. He didn't show off much to strangers, but he could do it. He knew his stuff all right. He was a very remarkable person. And another occasion I remember in Holland, when he was in a lodge, and some of the members brought to him an old gentleman with a beard, a venerable and very nice-looking old man, and said to Dr. Arundel, you know, this is Mr. So-and-so, Herr So-and-so, and he's been president of the lodge for 25 years. You know? Meaning, isn't that wonderful? And Dr. Arundel said, what a pity. Just like that, exactly as I'm saying it to you. I must say, I rather felt sorry for the old man. I hoped he didn't understand English. But Dr. Arundel was quite straight about it. He thought that officers should change with regularity. You don't necessarily have to make a rule about it, how many years, but they should change so that new influence comes into the lodge, you see. You want new influence. You want people doing things in another sort of way. I had this problem leaving the work in Europe. I mean, it's not too conceited, perhaps, to say that some people said to me, oh, why don't you stay on a bit longer? You know, people did say that. And I said, well, I think it's time, you know, to change. But we shan't get anybody who can do it in the same way as you, they said to me. Well, I said, well, that's exactly what you want. You want somebody who's going to do it differently. It's the whole point of having a change. You don't want someone who's going to do it the same way. You want a new influence, a new way of doing things, a new note struck, or whatever, you know what I mean, you see. And that change is very, very useful in all lodges. And we have in some parts of the world this fearful, what I call old man problem, and sometimes no woman problem, but usually it's an old man problem. There are lodges in Paris, for instance, which have long since forgotten what their names are, I think, because the same president's been there for such a long time that nobody remembers the lodge except under the name of the president. You see, it's really true. I mean, this is absolutely true. There is a lodge called Buddhidharma. Buddhidharma. And that is the lodge Buddhidharma. But really, everyone refers it to the Loge de Monsieur Gauthier Valter. And they call it Monsieur Gauthier Valter's lodge because he's been president of it for God knows how long. You see? Now, he ought to leave, with all, I feel. He ought to leave it and let someone else take over. That's what I think. But anyway, there it is. There's the Loge de Madame Sabaté, for instance. Madame Sabaté is a splendid student, a very, very nice woman. But she's been, I think she's been president of the lodge too long. See what I mean? It's change. And we have this problem in four countries in South America at present. Four countries where there are devoted, dedicated old men. And they've been students there for years and years and years and years. They're good students. But they have the thing absolutely like that. You know? We've always done it this way, and this is the way it's jolly well going to be done. You know, that sort of thing. And any new person comes along and wants to make a change. They try for a couple of times and then don't get anywhere, so they leave. And dozens of good potential members have been driven away in these different sections because these people will not leave go, see. And then they come and weep on your shoulder and say, I can't get anyone to help me. What am I going to do? I'm getting older. I can't. And it's their own fault. They won't let anybody help them. I'd like to just close with a meditation that we've used many times. And I think perhaps it's a simple way of closing our meeting. So let us sit comfortably and look at our thoughts. Just look at them. Don't try to drive them away. And don't try to hang on to them. But just realize that you are not them, that you are observing. You're standing aside and you're looking at these thoughts. They come and go like clouds across the sky, following one another, some larger, some smaller, some more slowly, some faster. But they come and they go, and you and I observe them. They are not you. Who are you? Who is this observer? Who is this watcher? Between the clouds there are spaces, and behind and beyond the clouds there is endless space, an infinitude of space, boundless and limitless. It is the space that watches. And in our deepest selves, we are the space. We are the one.